Hello and welcome to the Jesuit Border Podcast. This podcast explores the humanitarian response along the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. My name is Brian Strasburger.
And I'm Joe Noya. We're with Del Camino Jesuit Border Ministries, located in the Diocese of Brownsville, Texas.
This podcast aims to humanize the migrant experience by sharing stories from our ministry and highlighting some of the amazing work that people are doing along the border and throughout the country.
The Jesuit Border Podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post. Let's begin.
Vamos!
In this episode, we're going to talk about how we can do hard things.
That's right. We'll be interviewing Christine Meyer, who is a parishioner at the Church of St. Ignatius Loyola in New York City, a member of their Ignatian Social Justice Committee, and a volunteer with the Migrant Center at St. Francis of Assisi. Christine will be sharing her perspectives on what is happening in New York with the arrival of migrants and the local response. Stay tuned for that fascinating interview. But first, we want to share some stories of when we've seen how people can do hard things.
Yeah, one that comes to mind for me is a particular moment at a shelter in Matamoros. At this stage in the shelter's life, there was a severe food and water shortage. And this is the first time that I had seen groups of migrants getting visibly angry, especially mothers and fathers of young children. They were worried about not just malnutrition, but worries about disease, all this other stuff. And it was intense. Not gonna lie, it was pretty intense.
Yeah, I mean, obviously food and drink are essential. I mean, you need these to survive. And so, you know, how do you mobilize to be able to provide for people with that kind of a need? You know, you can't just have every single person fending for themselves with food and shelter if you're dealing with a migrant shelter, right? These are some essential and basic needs.
About as basic as it gets. And we really couldn't do anything about it except beyond like advocacy and prayers. And they were come to us to do something, but it's like,
yeah.
I can't really, it's kind of like literally the most I can do is also really kind of like the least I can do right now, which is just go to bat for you and also pray. But I was, like in my case, I think of like, all right, so who are the people, who's that prayer squad? You know, like who do you go to when you have intentions that are particularly urgent and need to get...
Why do I have a feeling that you've got a WhatsApp chat that's called Prayer Squad?
I don't. But I do have a group text.
Oh, there you go.
That's just my family. No, it's I think of like, it's my mom, my father, and my sister. Yeah, like... Everyone has like those people, you know, that when they say they're going to pray for you or for whatever intention, like you know that they're straight up going to. And like for them, it's them. So I hit them up. My sister goes to Facebook. She assembles her prayer squad.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. And later that day, a huge shipment of food and water from a church, I think in Georgia, comes down to that shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And like on one hand, this almost seems like a counterpoint to the we can do hard things thing, because we couldn't do anything, you know. but it's kind of like I couldn't do anything, but that means you just need to expand that I into a we, you know. We can do hard things, you know. Get that prayer squad together, and even if we can't really do something hard, well, God can definitely handle this. And I think of, like, this moment was kind of like, you know, God saying, you know, I got this. I know you care about them. Like, I care about them even more, you know? And God just coming through and showing me that, yeah, even if it feels like we can't do hard things, God still can.
That's right. And I think there was kind of the combination of so many elements there. I mean, the migrants themselves advocating for themselves and saying this is an issue and trying to tell anybody that they could, you know, we need some attentiveness. Advocates on the border here, including ourselves, putting out that message to other advocates? This is something beyond our capabilities, but does anyone know we need to get more a steady supply of food and water to the shelter, and for that to be extended, and then people to be able to respond and say, okay, that's something we can help provide in this way at this time, and coming together. So it's a network from the migrants themselves, mm-hmm. from local advocates, from the God's own providence and the intercession and of many in prayer, and the mobilization of resources to kind of bring it all together to accomplish what on the surface is essential, but a really hard thing to put together, especially on a quick turnaround.
Exactly.
And so that's one example of coming together to do hard things. And you know, sometimes that spirit of doing hard things can come up even in the story of individuals. And we see it in the resilience of so many migrants. One of the stories that comes to mind is an elderly Venezuelan migrant named Alejandro, who traveled up from Venezuela through, you know, overland, this incredibly long and hard journey with his adult son. And that whole trip ended up being just a lot longer and harder than he had expected or really felt prepared for. And then you end up in northern Mexico and you're trying to figure out what to do, how to get into the U.S. to get relief and access to the resources that you need. Right now, the reality is that a lot of people on the border are having to make hard choices. The choice to wait for an appointment with CBP-1, which could take months, I mean, we're talking about 3 months or more sometimes to wait for that, or the choice to turn yourself in, which is to say, cross the border, cross the river, the desert, wherever you are on the border, and just turn yourself into Border Patrol and say, I'm here to seek asylum, and now that I'm in the territory of your country, I'd like to seek asylum. Well, the U.S. government in this moment really wants migrants to enter with this smartphone app and wait and enter that way. And so it's put up a lot of barriers, a lot of punishments, we could almost say, in its policy for people who enter any other way, including crossing a river or over through the desert and just waiting and presenting yourself. And those punishments or penalties for people could include deportation back to your home country or getting you to sign paperwork to remove yourself voluntarily. You could end up detained for the entirety of your immigration proceedings in the U.S., or you could be released into the United States. What you might not realize is even as you're released into the U.S., it's presumed that you're ineligible to claim asylum. You might even be in place in some form of expedited removal where the U.S. is trying to get you out of the country super quickly. So the bottom line is migrants are left with these really hard choices, this choice to wait a long time for the appointment or to try to cross the river and just see how things go and see if things can end up in their favor without really knowing the possibilities. Well, we, of course, in our ministry are always encouraging people to wait for that appointment. Mm-hmm. It's a legal way to enter. It offers the most benefits. But people come with a lot of burdens, right? I mean, some people, they've got a very sick family member back home who is waiting to get some financial support to have a surgery. Others might be waiting for some debt that they have to pay to make the journey.
And sometimes when you're accompanying someone who is right in the midst of those dilemmas, you kind of have to tell them, look, like you have a handful of options. And honestly, none of them are really good.
Yeah.
We just kind of go through each option to try and get to this is the one that is least bad for you.
That's right. Yeah.
But just because the main option of waiting for that appointment is bad, like, man, don't think the alternatives are somehow any better because long-term, they're worse.
That's right, yeah. And that's what we especially try to impress on them is like, this is a long-term investment and you want the better for yourself and for your family for the long-term. But obviously, with the needs pressing upon someone, the immediacy of wanting to be in the country, it can make it a very difficult choice to have to face this possibility of a multi-month wait in northern Mexico. And so Alejandro comes to me one day. He's very emotional and he's crying and he says he's thinking of crossing the river and just turning himself in because he feels like all this time is being wasted in this shelter. He's just in this state of sadness and despair. I mean, it's a hard ask for him to keep waiting. So in that conversation with him, I just asked him, I was like, well, what are you doing? What are you doing here at the shelter? I wanted to try to get him to think about positive things. And he said, well, you know, I always take pictures of videos in you guys while you're doing your mass. And it's true because he takes a lot of pictures and videos of us when we're celebrating mass.
A good healthy lot.
Yeah. And sends it to all of us afterwards, videos, photos, everything from every angle, far more than we really need or ever use. But
our ministry is well documented.
Extremely well documented at the Pumarejo Shelter.
The archives will be angry with us at how well documented our ministry is.
I think the like capacity of my phone is angry with how well documented all of this is. But that was one thing, of course, that he mentioned. I said, well, who else could do that for us? You know, you do such a good job with that. He said, well, I'm also in charge of helping to set up and serve the meals for lunch and dinner that we serve here every day. I said, well, that's a great thing. I mean, you're serving other people around. He's like, well, yeah, and I'm also part of the cleaning team, and I help to, like, clean the space. I've got my rotation and who I help with and what I work with. I was like, Alejandro, that's what you're doing here. I mean, he was contributing in so many ways, and maybe he just needed to see that. And so I told him, maybe God needs you to be here right now to help out in all these ways. Like, can you be open to doing that, even if it's a really hard thing? And so Alejandro made the decision that he was going to stay there. He's going to keep doing all those things. We continue to get a ton of photos and videos from him every day from our mass, often with his own face featured in kind of selfie mode style, which is his preferred method of photo and video capture. But last week he comes up to me after our mass, or before our mass, I'm sorry, and he says to me with tears in his eyes, Salió la cita. I got my appointment. It was a moment of tremendous joy and relief for him and a sense of peace that he had done good things. He had waited in this very difficult situation for a long time, but that it was worth it, that it had its purpose. And that was so meaningful to him. Now, it was a hard thing for him to wait that long, for him to get that appointment and get into the country. And the truth is, hard things continue to await him. Getting that appointment is one step in the migrant journey, but it's not the last step. He's going to have to continue to do hard things as he gets situated in the country, finds work, finds a place to stay, goes through court proceedings, deals with any health issues he has. There's a lot of things that face migrants once they enter this country. That's why we're excited to welcome to our show today today's guest. Christine Meyer is a parishioner at the Church of St. Ignatius of Loyola in New York City and has been very active in the migrant response in New York City. If you follow the news, and you probably do, you've seen a lot of news reports of what's happening with migrants arriving in New York City. So we thought it'd be great for our listeners to hear an on-the-ground perspective who's someone right there in New York City helping to welcome and accompany migrants as they arrive. So stay tuned for that interview. Coming up next. We are excited to welcome to this week's episode Christine Meyer, who's a parishioner at the Church of St. Ignatius Loyola in New York City. Christine is a member of the Ignatian Social Justice Committee and a migrant in working in migrant accompaniment, and she's come to visit us here in the RGV twice. Christine, it's great to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Father Brian.
Maybe just to get things started, you could give us a little background of how you even ended up on this podcast, which I think the origin story is going to be one that's fascinating in terms of what it was that piqued your interest in immigration and then how you got involved with your parish in this issue.
Sure. So, and thank you. Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to have the chance to tell the story of what's happening in New York and what's happening in our parish. Yeah, so I've always been fascinated by immigration, migration, and also have felt like it's an issue that's very close to my heart. I'm first generation. My parents were immigrants to this country. And they came, you know, as what we would call today economic migrants. They came from post-war Germany, which was still trying to get its feet underneath it. And they just wanted to, my mom said, you know, she just wanted to come here and make some money so that she could buy a car. She met my dad, had some kids, and the rest is history. And I have always felt very grateful, just enormously grateful to this country for the opportunities that it's given. And it makes me, it just brings me a lot of sadness when I see that attitude towards migrants and towards any kind of immigrants turning in a way that's not welcoming. So it's always been, I would say, as I look through the line of my life, a goal of mine both to serve this country, but also to serve immigrants whenever I can. So that I would say that's kind of my deep backstory. But more directly, you know, I joined the Church of St. Ignatius Loyola when I moved to Manhattan about 2 years ago, and joined the Ignatian Social Justice Committee with Laura de Bois Blanc, who I know you know, and some other folks. And we were talking about issues that were, you know, really that we were passionate about. And, you know, a number of us brought up the issue of migration. And so we all did some, we said, well, we'll go and research, you know, how can we help? So I called you, actually, Father Brian. We got your name through one of the priests who was working at the parish at the time. And, you know, quite frankly, we thought, well, Father Brian's going to ask us to, you know, collect some money. Maybe we're going to send down some school supplies or something. You know, we'll do something from afar, from New York. And that's not what you said. You said, and I'm sure you say this to a lot of people, you said, come and see. You said, Jesus extended the invitation, come and see. And that's what you should do. And that's what we did. So a group of five of us, about a little over a year and a half ago, came down. And you took us to, at that time, it was the Plaza in Reynosa, Mexico. And I might tear up as I'm saying this, but I remember being in that plaza, you know, and just seeing at the same time the deprivation, just, I mean, such sadness, thousands of people crammed into a very small, muddy, damp plaza underneath, you know, tents that were falling apart. And yet at the same time, seeing, quite frankly, the face of Christ. You know, seeing Christ in the mud and seeing Christ in the people who were kneeling in that mud, seeing Christ in the stories, the tragic stories, but also in the hugs that followed the sharing of those stories. And for me, once I saw the face of Christ in that way, I couldn't unsee it. I couldn't unsee it, and I couldn't fail to do something in response. And I know others in our parish felt the same way.
I'm thinking of your visit down here. Now, I wasn't able to be a part of that. I wasn't able to see that. But I am curious about maybe what you might have noticed. Because I feel like for a lot of people when they visit the board, this is definitely my experience, there were some things that I noticed that, you know, might get, how do I say, overlooked in the common narrative. Like for in my case, man, you just don't hear so much in the mainstream media about all the kidnappings, for example, that could happen. Or there could be other aspects of personal stories or something like that that just really get overlooked. And I was wondering if you picked up on something when you were here, that first visit, if there was something that stood out to you that you're like, oh man, if only more people knew about this.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing comes to mind very quickly, and that is the faith of the migrants, the faith, both in their, just in their everyday language, it comes out, you know, gracias a Dios, thanks be to God that we're here, or, you know, vaya con Dios, go with God when we depart. You know, or bless you, or, you know, thank you so much. Thanks, you know, thanks for your blessings. Their faith is woven in just to their everyday life in a way that I think is just different from, you know, the typical, certainly my typical experience, even as a practicing Catholic, and not something that I knew, you know, and not something that I realized. And quite frankly, I was, came away from that first trip inspired by their faith. Yeah. Like I said, you know, people kneeling in the mud to receive communion, going up on that, not just the communion line, but just the blessing line, wanting a blessing from a priest. They were hungry for the Eucharist. They were hungry for the presence of a tangible presence of God, beyond the presence that so many of them clearly felt very strongly.
That's so true. I'm so inspired also by the faith of migrants. It obviously motivates our work as priests and Jesuits wanting to go and bring sacramental ministry, bring the Mass to migrant camps and shelters. And, you know, another thing I'd love to hear from you, Christine, you know, when we're talking about immigration, we're talking about your visits to the border. Maybe now we could talk a little bit about the reality in New York City, because as far as immigration is concerned in the United States, I often feel right now that New York City is in the news more than the border. And I think it's a big city, and what's happening there might be kind of unique. So I wonder if you could kind of touch on it from a New Yorker's perspective, from the perspective of someone who's helping to accompany migrants. I know you also volunteer at the Migrant Center at St. Francis of Assisi Parish. Maybe if you could just share your perspective of the dynamic happening right now in New York City, and maybe offer your own commentary on it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The situation in New York is tricky. It really is tricky. Your listeners may know that New York is a right to shelter city. That covers the migrants as well. So when they come in and have no place to stay, you know, traditionally, as you know, New York is, you know, the home of immigrants. I mean, it's the city of immigrants. But the way that that tended to happen, as it did with my parents when they came to New York, is there was some relative here that they stayed with for a while and then, you know, slowly moved on. And for many, many of these folks, there is no relative to stay with. So the city shelters are definitely overwhelmed. The city has contracted with well over 200 facilities. Last I heard, and that number may be higher by now, hotels, former college dormitories, other places that have space in order to house both the single individuals and then also the families. And it has been tough, right? Because New York, the tricky piece for New York is that it's a city that promises shelter, but it's in an ecosystem of rules and regulations that are national and that are state level. So it not everything is under New York City's control. And my heart goes out not only to the folks that are having to do the planning for all of this, but also for, you know, each of those shelters has a social worker, they have guards and security, they have folks doing some of the feeding. And I've met a lot of those folks, and they are just absolutely doing the best they can. And again, talk about people who are not in the news, and whose stories don't get told. I wish they would. But on the other hand, at the same time as I can appreciate the difficulty that New York City as a municipal entity is going through, I really, really wish that the rhetoric around things like collapse of our city, chaos, would just stop. It's not helpful. It's not helpful. And it's contrary to what I see on an everyday basis, which is so many New Yorkers, you know, doing legal clinics, pro bono legal clinics, like the one that I'm involved in the schools, the teachers that are helping to integrate the kids, in food pantries, and migrants, frankly, helping each other too. There's so many good people helping and wanting to extend that helping hand. And again, that is a message that's not coming out. So hopefully out there in your listener audience, there's someone who makes film documentaries or something else that can tell that story. Because, you know, I think back to when Angela Merkel had the influx of Syrian refugees, a million Syrian refugees that they were going to take. And her attitude was, you know, wir schaffen das, right? We can do that. We can handle this. You know, we've done hard things in the past. And that's, I wish New York as an official stance would take on that attitude, because it definitely is the attitude of so, so many people who are helping out day to day.
Yeah, I'm kind of touched by the reality of, you know, migrants helping other migrants, because that's, you kind of hear sometimes about, when you talk about the collapse of the city, some of the rhetoric that gets told. Some of the rhetoric that I'll often hear is this attitude of migrants really just kind of wanting handouts. But what I'm experiencing so often here on the border is an earnest desire to work. An earnest desire also to serve. I think of some people in the shelters, especially in Reynosa, where there's this one guy from El Salvador who's been injured, and he just wants to heal up so he can help the sisters, like and the other migrants in the kitchen, and just get to work for the other migrants. And so it's the work of migrants is something that needs to be held up. And you mentioned also the stories of these New Yorkers who are kind of coming together to serve the migrants. I wonder, is there a particular story, a particular person that comes to mind, something that, oh man, we need to tell this person's story, this person who is really kind of giving it all for the migrants?
Oh gosh. There's so many. I guess in that regard, if I had to tell one story, I would tell the story of my friend Nula. My friend Nula O'Doherty Naranja, who is she's a retired, I believe I'm saying this right, Manhattan prosecutor. She was an attorney. And she worked for Manhattan until I think just around the time that just before COVID. And when she saw all this happening with migrants, her husband as well is from, I believe, Ecuador, if I'm remembering the country right. And her heart just said, I have to do something here. I'm a lawyer. I have these skills and capacities. So she opened up the basement of her house as a legal clinic in Jackson Heights, Queens. And I've gone there many times. In fact, our legal clinic in St. Francis is affiliated with her. And she starts the day at 10 o'clock with a charlar, a chat with the migrants, sort of a basic overview of the system, of asylum, of TPS. She helps out. She has a whole cadre of volunteers who help out to fill out those asylum applications. And they are all themselves recent immigrants, recent migrants. And then she goes out around 3 o'clock midday and sets up a folding table and a couple of metal chairs in basically what's a park close to her house, and just takes all comers, just takes questions from all comers. And they line up, several deep. And she just one by one gives, legal advice as she can. It's a sight to behold. I have many, many times gotten texts from her still at 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night, 1, 2 in the morning. She just keeps working until the last, until she basically can't do anymore and sleeps a little and gets up at 10 o'clock the next morning to start again. She's an absolute tour de force, but with a heart of gold.
It's an inspiring story, and I'm sure it's one of many inspiring stories of people in New York responding to the current situation with an attitude of, we can do this. We can do hard things, right? Like, this might be a challenging time right now with migrants arriving and not having a place to stay and needing some guidance and assistance. And I think that kind of paints a bit of the picture that can be helpful, that we can lose sight of even just being here on the border, is that a lot of times, especially when we're accompanying migrants in northern Mexico, the big thing is, how do they get into the United States of America? Like, what is a legal way for them to enter the country? Okay, you got to use this smartphone app, you got to download it, send this advance information, you got to wait for this appointment, and then when you get there, you have to meet with Border Patrol, present some information, and then you get released into the country. Congratulations. Sometimes I can feel at the border like that's the end of the story, and then they get on a bus and they go to some city and happily ever after. But we know that's not true, and I think you can provide maybe our listeners with a little bit of an overview of what are some of the challenges that remain for a migrant who gets on a bus. They've gotten a limited release parole into the United States with their family. They're coming to New York City. Maybe they have family there, maybe not. They're legally in the country. They are documented migrants, but the challenges remain. So could you maybe talk a little bit about what some of those challenges are, just to kind of paint a picture of what it looks like for a migrant that's arriving into our country?
Oh, gosh. The challenges are myriad. you know, they, and in, at least in New York City, they don't have to worry. Well, at least on paper, at least theoretically, they don't have to worry about the challenge of finding a place to sleep and getting something that vaguely resembles a meal, getting some food. But everything beyond that, and even there, sometimes for whatever reason, you know, the system is under strain and under stress. The biggest challenge is that they are not legally allowed to work. So even if you have a roof over your head, even if you get some food, where are you going to get another change of clothes from? And New York is cold, especially coming up. And if you're from Venezuela, it's really hard to convey to the Venezuelans just how cold it's going to get. So, you know, always have a pair of gloves in your pocket, you know, so we have to sort of tell them. And then schooling, if they have children, to get them into the schools are quite at capacity. So even if you, you know, are able, and you're able to, they definitely accommodate all the kids, but your school may be a good hour away by subway. And guess what? The subway costs $2.95 a ride. So how are you going to pay for that if you can't find a job? Then on top of that, you know, medical issues, a lot of them come with, you know, we've had numerous cases of the chicken pox. And of course, trauma, right? They're all dealing with trauma, which shows up in different ways, be it, you know, children having difficulty in school, be it, you know, depression among parents. I mean, these people have been through tough times. And that we haven't even started to talk about the legal process. You know, the legal system, all of the pro bono legal providers in New York are completely overwhelmed, which is why at St. Francis Assisi, we stepped in to supplement some of that work. The challenges ahead are still many, and we haven't even talked about learning English, which is another challenge.
Kind of go to backtrack and just kind of go back to the being a parishioner thing. And so one of the, I guess you know, it's one of the big parts of, ideally, of being a parishioner is this as service. You know, and so I mean, you talk about this great work of service that you're doing. And another part of being a parishioner is, you know, going to Mass. And I find definitely my own experience that, you know, coming down to the border, that my very first time and going to Mass there, here on the border, man, that kind of impacted subsequent Masses since then. Like, I don't know, it's like sometimes you kind of get a glimpse into a reality in a new way, and it affects the following Masses of your life sometimes. And I'm curious, how has Mass changed for you, if it has?
Oh, what a terrific question. And you're right. I don't know if you've been to, and I don't know if your listeners have been to St. Ignatius Loyola Parish, to the church itself in...
I have, and it is spectacular.
It is spectacular. It is on Park Avenue, which is, you know, one of the ritziest, and in on the Upper East Side, and one of the ritziest areas in New York. It is clad head to toe in gorgeous marble, gold leaf paint, unbelievable mosaics, stained glass. I mean, it's glorious. It's glorious. I write a newsletter that I send out to friends of mine about things that we're doing, trips to the border and such. And in one of them, I did a side-by-side picture of the what it looks like at Mass at St. Ignatius and what it looked like at Mass in the tent, the big tent in Reynosa. And every time I go into my church of St. Ignatius, which I love, I mean, it is a beautiful, beautiful space. And it definitely brings me closer to God in a way too. I mean, beauty can do that. But I cannot go into that church without also seeing in my mind that tent in Reynosa in the plaza. And I think what that means, in a way, it's a contrast, And yes, I see that. I see the rich and the poor kind of contrast. But it also reminds me that God is everywhere, absolutely everywhere, without any boundaries. You know, we talk a lot about preferential treatment for the poor, and God is certainly there. But God is also in that rich church, and he can use that beautiful space and that soaring music to move parishioners' hearts, because I tell you, our parish, we just rolled basically this accompaniment program out to the parish starting in September of this year. So we're talking about 2 months. And the response of people to our requests for help have been absolutely inspirational. So God works, you know, God is there in the Plaza of Reynosa, but God is also very much alive on Park Avenue in New York City. And I would imagine a lot of listeners wouldn't expect to find God in New York City necessarily either.
Wondering, Christine, if you could share from your work with migrants there in New York City, people who are arriving, maybe that you've met at the migrant center you volunteer at or through the parish, if there's just a story that you'd like to hold up, someone maybe that you encountered recently that kind of humanizes the migrant experience and tells a little of the story of people who are arriving in New York right now.
Oh, gosh. Thank you for asking, Father Brian. You know, there are so many stories. Each of these migrants, you know, is amazing in their own way. But one person who's really close to my heart is a new friend, Maria. And Maria is indeed married to Jose.
Oh, isn't that perfect? Mary and Joseph.
Mary and Joseph, Maria and Jose. And they are from Venezuela. They have 5 children. 4 of them are here. And since coming here, Maria has had so much thrown at her. She started off in a shelter that was really just a temporary situation. They didn't have any food. It was really, really difficult. So she had to advocate for getting into decent shelter. She had to advocate for getting her kids into schools together because they were in schools that were all over the place, you know, an hour away to the by train to the south, another hour away to the north. It was crazy. At the same time, she was dealing with a nephew who had suffered a severe spinal cord injury in Chicago, and she was the only sort of older family member in the United States. So she was trying to coordinate that care at the same time. And, you know, it just over and over again. Oh, and then one of her children actually came up by himself and so was in unaccompanied minor detention as well. So she lost track of him for a few days. And so it was just one thing after another. And it just so reminds me of Mother Mary, right? And when she started off in her journey and how everything was thrown at her, right? She's pregnant and then it's not by Joseph. And then she has to travel while pregnant to another town and she's got to go on a donkey on the dusty roads. And then there's no place for her to give birth. And then she has to flee to Egypt. And then Jesus gets lost in the temple. You know, our Maria, my Maria, is similarly to Mary, you know, just has one thing after another thrown at her. And through that, both Marias persist. You know, they persist because of this just enormous wellspring of faith. And also, you know, I think about Mother Mary and how she must have, knowing this, how precious this child was that she had, that she just had to do everything within her power to protect this child. And our Maria is the same way. Those precious, precious children, one of whom I just hugged this morning, she has to do everything in her power to protect them and to see them through to a better life. And so I'm just in awe. I'm just in awe, and it has given me renewed appreciation for what Mother Mary went through as well with Jesus.
I feel like you just went full circle when you were talking about God being everywhere. You know. I feel like, wow, it's right here in that story of all of these different parallels from the life of Mary, life of Christ, Maria's own story. And there's this kind of the way of just this ripple effect of the Christ event and Christ stories throughout history, in the lives of so many people. So often we reflect on the migrant experience of the Holy Family in our in our own ministry, here again these families of migrants who are doing what they can for their family, and there's a holiness in that. It's just, I don't know, this kind of this full circle thing of what you just did.
Yeah, it's really, it's the face of Christ, isn't it? It's the face of Christ in our world, right there in front of you, if you choose to see it.
I think just the importance of faith and prayer is like as a foundation and kind of like a jumping off platform, a base, if you will, from going out to do the mission. So think about the faith, and then also think about something you were talking about with the parish, about this being this beautiful parish. This materially beautiful parish. And I can't quite help but think that there's probably some connection between the tremendous beauty of the parish and this movement in the parishioners' hearts to give, the way that somehow beauty can call us out of ourselves. And just how all these different things, from the faith, the beauty of the parish, the hope and the service, all these things can be connected. And, well, it kind of makes me think of heaven, because in many ways, heaven can be described as this situation in which you see all these things connected in God's providence, and you start learning to see just how great God is, how great God has been working all this time. And so I'm wondering, you know, with all the different images of heaven out there and ways of seeing heaven, if there's a particular understanding of heaven or a particular vision of heaven that you have that really moves you. Like, what is, when you think of the wonder and the amazingness of heaven, what comes to mind for you?
Wow, that's a tough question. The word that comes to mind is love, right? It's just a place where, to me, in my, the way I think about my faith, I don't really think about it as a, you know, place with clouds and sort of angels with harps. Maybe that's going to be, and I certainly hope they're angels with harps, because I love music. So I want nothing more than angels with harps to be greeting me, for sure.
What 90s hip hop heaven.
But, you know, what I think of when I think about heaven and love is I think about that feeling, for example, that feeling that we had on Saturday. There were, you know, 80 people that were gathered to provide some warm winter clothing to our migrants. And you were talking about migrants helping migrants. They each brought two friends. We had a migrant that we invited from Brazil, and she brought a friend, another migrant friend from Mauritania and another migrant friend from Haiti. And they just showed up. And to stand and watch all of that happening, you know, the giving, the receiving, the laughing, the kids playing. We have four priests in the parish. Each and every one of them came at one point in time or another to be part of the of that day. That feeling that I have, and it's not just it's a feeling, but it's more than that. That's to me what love is. That's the connection of people. And to me, that's heaven. I hope that's what heaven is like.
I hope so too. That's a beautiful image of love. People gathering together, sharing time, sharing space, inviting others into that space. I think that's exactly what, you know, that's a beautiful image of heaven that can speak to all of us. You know, Christine, it's been a pleasure having you here on this podcast. I think my biggest takeaway, I just want to make sure I have this right, is that New York City is a place that's going to offer free housing, and that you at the parish will accompany them through the whole migrant journey. And so anyone looking for help and a place to stay here on the border, I can just send them your cell phone number and sponsor
address.
Oh, please
don't say that. Mayor Adams is going to be furious at me. Mayor Adams is going to have my head.
Was that the wrong takeaway? Oh, gosh, shoot. I think you bring a great message to the podcast and a great message to your own ministry to say, you know, we can do hard things, we can do this, we can respond, and we really appreciate all the work that everyone at the parish at the Church of St. Ignatius of Loyola is doing. We've loved your visits, and we hope you make another one soon.
Oh, you can count on that.
Great. Thanks so much, Christine.
All right. Take it easy.
Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. We're grateful to Christine Meyer for joining us.
Remember to subscribe to this podcast to hear more about the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. You can visit our website at delcamino.org.
If you're curious about Jesuit life or know someone who is, visit beajesuit.org to learn more about a religious vocation to the Society of Jesus.
This podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post.
We'll see you next time on the Jesuit Border Podcast.
Que Dios los bendiga.